Chair, for those of you who don't know me, I'll just give you 30 seconds of background. I hail from St. Louis Park. I grew up in Golden Valley, so I'm a Western suburban Twin Cities person. I'm a lawyer by practice. I'm in the courts frequently and do a little bit of appellate work as well, but that tends to get set aside for a large part during the legislative session. I've been on the committee now for, I don't know how many years. Not as long as Senator Limmer has. I did chair it the last time the Democrats had the majority. I'm glad to return as the chair now. And I'm looking forward to a very interesting and productive legislative session. I'm going to have a few other remarks to make, but before I do, I'd like to start out by having every new member here introduce themselves and have staff introduce themselves as well, so we can all know who the people are that are going to have such a big impact on what we do. So I will start to my right with our vice chair.
Hello, my name is Claire Umover-Baton. I represent District 66, which is St. Paul, Roseville, Falcon Heights, and Lauderdale, and very excited to be serving as a vice chair of this committee.
Diana Rico, the CLA for Senator Ron Latz.
Of course, I just put coughed up in my mouth. Sorry about that. I'm Sandy Pappas, state senator from St. Paul. You're all in my district. For those of you who don't know that, welcome. I've been in the legislature for several decades, and I was on the Judiciary Public Safety Committee when I was a House member, so I was House trained, but I've just been on this committee for the last 6 years. So looking forward to working with everyone and getting a lot of good work done.
Hi, I'm Jim Carlson. I represent Senate District 52, which is Eagan, Burnsville, and Mendota Heights, and the city of Mendota. And I've been in the legislature for 14 years, and this is the first time that I've been on the Judiciary Committee. I'm looking forward to serving here. And I've been in front of the Judiciary Committee many times, which sometimes was rewarding, sometimes not so much. But I'm looking forward to being able to serve everyone. Thank you.
I'm Bonnie Westland. I am the senator from Plymouth, Medicine Lake, and one precinct in Maple Grove. This is my first term, and I am honored and privileged to be here among my colleagues and to serve the people not only of the district but the state of Minnesota. So I'm looking forward to serving on the Judiciary Committee.
I'm Senator Judy Seeberger from Senate District 41, which is the Lake Elmo, Afton, Cottage Grove, Hastings area. I am thrilled to be here and very excited to begin our work here in the Judiciary Committee.
I'm Warren Limmer. I represent most of Maple Grove and six other cities in west central Hennepin County. Before this year, I was the chairman of the committee. Ron and I, we kind of tag team back and forth over the last few years. So it's your turn at bat, Mr. Chairman, and look forward to a productive session.
I'm Jeff Howe. I serve in a district that wraps around basically St. Cloud. I have a history with being in the fire service, and in the House, I served on the Public Safety Committee, but this is my first shot at this in the Senate, and so I look forward to having a good, productive session.
Hi, I'm Michael Kroon. Represent District 32, which is the entire cities of Blaine, Columbus, and Lexington, and about half of Ham Lake. My day job is I'm a lawyer. I've done 15 years of real estate litigation. In the last 4 years, I managed litigation for a company. It's my first term in the Senate.
Hello, I'm Ken Backus. I'm the nonpartisan Senate counsel for the committee. I handle the criminal justice side of things. We have another attorney who's out sick today, Priya, who does the civil side of things. And this is my 29th session.
I'm Chris Turner. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee. This is my 33rd session.
Linnea Michelson, Center for Republican Research, 18th session.
Jackie Clinton, Center for Alcohol Research for Judiciary, I've been here since 2015 and with the committee since 2019.
Hi, I'm Tristan Vagsy. I'm the LA for Senator Umu Verbaten, and this is the start of my second week.
Same.
I'm just a committee page.
You're not just a judge.
Hi, my name is Kaylee Courtney. I'm one of the nonpartisan committee pages. So, do you need anything?
Thank you. Nicole?
Nicole Kaplan, committee administrator.
So thank you to our pages and everyone else who is here that will make this committee work well. So I just want to make a brief opening remark. We have a very exciting session ahead of us. There are a lot of issues that are going to come before this committee, many of which I think will be consensus-oriented, bipartisan issues, some of which will not be. That's the nature of the process. But all of which I hope we will work productively to evaluate, interpret, fix if we think they can be fixed, and then speak and vote our consciences as we believe is appropriate for the proposals that come before us. This has never been a rubber stamp committee. I don't expect that it will be. I don't think we're playing a productive role if that's all that we do. So. Plus, lawyers are very good at finding ways to parse language. I prefer to send bills out of here that are ready to become law. If they are not, I don't like to fix bills on the floor, especially judiciary-type fixes on the floor, because it's not a good place to have these kind of discussions. So I prefer to do the committee work in the committee. I welcome and encourage all members of the committee to approach it the same way. I hope that we can work in a bipartisan fashion where it's possible and we can become a good team as we try to improve state law. That said, I do want to encourage members of this committee to take advantage of an opportunity for some continuing legal education credits and information. I want to invite Joel Carlson real quickly up to the testifier's desk to give us some information on that. Joel, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and it's a pleasure to be back in front of you, Mr. Chairman, and you, Senator Limmer. I won't tell you how many sessions I've been at the Capitol, but it exceeds 40. I wanted to just let the members know you may have gotten an email, and you should have gotten a Save the Date card for a program that we have worked on with the Association for Justice, one of my clients, and Mitchell Hamlin, now used to be William Mitchell, now Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. It's called the Law School for Legislators, and it is an opportunity to provide some basic training for freshmen and for non-lawyers. But over the years, we started this in 1999. Over the years, we have expanded that to staff, and others around the Capitol complex that want to get the training. We do it now remotely, so it's very easy to participate. It's on February 20th in the afternoon and February 27th by Zoom. And we have a very good program lined up for you this year in conjunction or talking with the chairs in the House and Senate. We're going to have a section on cannabis. We're going to have a section on juveniles in the justice system. We're going to have a section on bail reform. These are all taught by law professors at Mitchell Hamlin. We've got they have a new center there, institute at the law school on Native law and tribal sovereignty, and we're going to have the director of that new institute give a presentation. So we encourage you to come. If you didn't get an email from staff or us to register for the program, please reach out. I know Nicole has the email version of the invite. I think I first met Senator Howe at that over at Mitchell Hamlin many years ago when he first came to the legislature, and it's always been a good opportunity. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting us give you a little information about it. Happy to answer questions, and I can talk to anybody offline afterwards. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. All right, let's jump right in. We have until 2:30, so we're going to start with a presentation from the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Come on up, Commissioner Schnell, and anyone else that you seek to have at the table.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For those who are in the room, there is a paper copies of the handout of the PowerPoint slides we're going to go over here. Just want to make sure that people have access to them. Chair and members, my name is Paul Schnell, and I have the honor of serving as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. Thank you for having me here today and the opportunity to provide an overview of the important work of the Department of Corrections. I'm honored to have the chance to work with all of you, and I look forward to meeting each of you individually in the coming days and weeks. Please know that you can always reach out to me, my staff, both Emily Leffholz, who is our legislative director, and Safia Khan over there, who is the chief of staff, at any time. The DOC's mission is to transform the lives for safer Minnesota. The work of the DOC not only makes our state a safer place to live, work, and raise a family, successful rehabilitation results in reduced crime, fewer victims, less fear, and reduced cost. We often hear about the need to break the cycle in the criminal legal system, and the Department of Corrections and our corrections partners endeavor to do just that. Mr. Chair and committee members, in the interest of time, I'm not going to go over this slide, except to say that the department's strategic plan guides our work, and I wanted to give you copies of the agency's strategic plan for your packets, and hopefully to help guide our discussion. Over the past few years, even with all the focus required to manage COVID in our prisons, we reorganized the department to be more person-centered, data-focused, evidence-based, and transformative. While we've made progress, we have a long way to go. The DOC is the third largest state agency and is extremely complex, but our work essentially boils down to this. First, we develop individualized plans to rehabilitate those in the systems based on their needs and their individual risk factors. Second, we provide programming and services and supervision to those individuals while they are incarcerated. And third, we provide intervention and support services to those on probation or supervised release so they reintegrate or transition to the community and live pro-social lives. The numbers on this next slide provide a high-level overview of the department. The DOC has a very large and dedicated workforce, but like other public safety sectors, we are experiencing significant challenges in recruiting and retaining our staff. Our biennial budget is approximately $1.2 billion. Our work with you and this committee is so critical because the Department of Corrections is 96% funded by the state's general fund. The DOC has an enormous footprint across the state, 11 prisons and 7.5 million square feet of facility space, making our bonding request just to address deferred maintenance critical. I'll speak more to the numbers on capacity and community supervision shortly. Also, for your reference, this slide is a quick overview of the 11 facilities that the DOC operates. I would encourage you to tour the facilities and speak directly to our staff and the individuals incarcerated in them. A couple of references of note. The facility in Shakopee is Minnesota's only women's prison. Red Wing is a juvenile correctional facility focusing on treatment of the youth placed there. The St. Cloud facility serves as the central intake facility for men in our state. Faribault is the state's largest facility with a population capacity of just over 2,000. And the Togo site near Canada is the smallest facility, one of the two men's boot camp facilities. The prisons in St. Cloud and Stillwater are both well over 100 years old. As you can see, Minnesota's prison population is staggeringly disproportionate and an issue that we must and are devoting attention to. I also want to draw your attention to the numbers on the right side of that slide. Each of these data points reflects a unique and important challenge to your work as well as ours. And I hope you will keep them front of mind as you continue to make decisions during the course of this session. Mr. Chair and members, if there is one thing I'd like you to take away from my presentation with you today, is this. Over 95% of the men and women in the state's prisons will return to neighborhoods across our state. Because of this, we must ensure that those in our care, custody, and control have access to the services and supports needed. The safety of our state depends upon it. Over the past few years, we have been restructuring and reorganizing the department, focused on creating a more person-centered approach to our work. Simply put, the person-centered approach organizes and matches evidence-based programs and services targeted at the individualized needs and risk factors of the people in the system. Research tells us that this is what works. More on this another day. I have two slides to illustrate both the historical and projected prison population. Here you can see that the population has declined dramatically during the COVID-19 pandemic. Court backlogs during shutdowns and efforts at the local level to keep individuals out of high-risk congregate living settings drove prison commitments down dramatically. Also note that just a few years ago, the state's incarcerated population was above the state's capacity, resulting in many conversations about whether the state should build another prison. Chair Latz, you at the time were a leader in guiding those conversations, and we appreciate your thoughtful leadership. In addition, the decline from 2015 to 2019 was due in large part to drug sentencing reform passed by the legislature in 2016. On this slide, you will see again the effect of COVID on the state's prison population. The COVID population downturn resulted in the agency taking approximately an $21 million budget reduction. You can see the projected exponential population growth that we project as the court works through its COVID backlog. We project that the capacity we will reach capacity by 2025. The line should be down a little bit lower there, as you can see. But this number reflects single bunking at the Stillwater as recommended by the 2020 OLA report on prison safety. And also note that the Rush City remains double bunked despite the fact that it was built as a single bunked facility. Now I'll briefly provide an overview of the agency. As I mentioned, we are the third largest agency in the state, and our work is divided across various divisions. I've had the pleasure of serving as commissioner for the past 4 years, and I tell you I'm immensely proud of the work that the agency and DOC staff and supervision partners from across the state have done. They have been front and center, delivering services around the clock, even throughout the COVID pandemic. Prior to serving in this role, I had the honor of working in policing, a deputy sheriff in Carver County, a dozen years with the St. Paul Police Department, and as police chief in the cities of Hastings, Maplewood, and Invergrove Heights. And just out of college, I worked in community-based corrections for about 6 years. Now I'd like to just cover the different units in the facilities, starting with the Facilities Division. Our largest division is the Facilities Safety and Security Division, which consists of over 2,000 uniformed security staff. Our Office of Special Investigations, which includes a licensed law enforcement contingent focused on fugitive apprehension, our safety office, and other core functions such as capital resources. Correctional facilities are essentially unique, secure communities and requiring a large dedicated staff to keep them running safely. The division is overseen by Deputy Commissioner Michelle Smith. The Reintegration and Restorative Services Division includes our Reentry Services Unit, the Hearings and Release Unit, our Juvenile Justice Reform Unit, Risk Assessment and Community Notification, Grants and Subsidies, and the large Community Supervision Unit. Deputy Commissioner Shanklin, Curtis Shanklin, oversees this division. We'll talk more about this later, but I do want to make sure I point out that the DOC provides community supervision and probation services in many smaller counties across the state of Minnesota. But it is important to note that there are three delivery systems of supervision in the state, and the DOC is proud to work with our county community supervision partners, both the Community Corrections Act counties and the county probation offices who provide the majority of supervision services across our state. Next, the Health Recovery and Programs Division. This division houses all the DOC's health services, which are constitutionally mandated, including treatment services, medical care, and other programming work of the department. Programming in prisons can include anything from cognitive behavioral therapy to spiritual services, and all depend upon robust case management services. This work falls under the division overseen by Assistant Commissioner Nan Larson. Our Organizational and Regulatory Services Division consists of the operational infrastructure and regulatory units of the department, including human resources, the Office of Professional Accountability, peer support, IT, victim assistance and restorative justice unit, and our jail inspections and enforcement unit. This team that licenses and inspects local jails and juvenile facilities across the state. Assistant Commissioner Connie Jones oversees this division. Within the Commissioner's office, we have several key agency-wide services, including policy and rulemaking, legislative affairs, tribal relations, equity, access and inclusion, project management, and research planning and performance. These are all overseen by our Chief of Staff, Assistant Commissioner Safia Khan. Finally, there are three members of the office who you should also know. Emily Leffels, who I mentioned earlier, our legislative director, is best contact with any inquiry about the DOC or questions from constituents, or to request a tour. She also previously worked for Chair Latz and is a good resource for the DOC and on how we can support this body. Kwesi Pasley is our CFO. He will be the point of contact on budget discussions. Our former longtime CFO, Chris Dodge, retired just last month. And finally, Karen Robinson is our general counsel and leads our Office of Legal Services. Chair and committee members, the work of corrections is hard. Our staff deserve a lot of credit for the contributions they make to the lives of those who are incarcerated, as well as the impact they have on public safety in our state. We are grateful, members, to you, our elected leaders, who are invested in them and the outcome of the DOC's work. Correctional services have a direct impact on public safety, including crime reduction, that means fewer victims and safer communities. One percentage point reduction in the state's three-year re-imprisonment rate would yield an estimated $5.4 million in costs avoided to the DOC and an estimated $57.7 million in costs avoided to the state, business, and society in general. And we hope to talk more with you about that in future meetings. As this slide points out, that we know that it is a small percentage of our population that commit a disproportionate amount of crime. And it is important that we focus on those at greatest risk. Finally, members, I would just say that it's hard to understand this work without seeing it firsthand. And there is nothing like seeing it firsthand. And with that, I would invite you to come and consider a tour, visiting one of our facilities anywhere in our system, to have the opportunity to talk with our staff and meet some of the people who are incarcerated there. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions by any members of the committee? All right. Very good. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you so much, Commissioner, for that overview. That was excellent. And I know I was checking off the prisons that I've visited. Personally, I thought, oh, well, I've never been there. I guess I need to go to Rush City. Question for me is, as we look at you know, the growth, the prison growth again, do you think that's due to the getting caught up with the backlog that we have because of COVID, or is it due to kind of this crime spree we're seeing? And then do you have any recommendations or advice as to how we could reduce the prison population? Like, for example, if we're reforming the cannabis laws, maybe we need to reform some of the sentencing in that area as well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, it's a great question. As we look at this, we do believe that a lot of this population swing is really the result of COVID and the backlog in the courts. Prior to COVID, we were at about 9,600 in terms of population when we first came here in 2019. Over the course of time, we saw some reductions. But ultimately, a lot of this, the dramatic drop, really resulted from COVID. I think the state is at a critical juncture, and we will have to make some decisions. While Minnesota has one of the lowest incarceration rates in the state, in the country, I should say, I think it's really important as we look to our neighbors to the east. We have 11 prisons in our state. The state of Wisconsin has 23. They have over 20,000 people in prison. And when you look at rates of safety, their state is not any safer because they incarcerate at a higher rate than we do. And I think that's important and notable. So I think establishing and having really good policies that ultimately ensure that we're providing the kinds of services that are going to reduce the risk of reoffending is the place that the state needs to double down. And we will be coming forward with a proposal that does exactly that. It addresses and focuses on ultimately this rehabilitative focus that needs to happen. We know, as I pointed out at the very end there, driving down recidivism, that 3-year reincarceration rate by 1% is $5.4 million in direct cash DOC costs. And $57 million in broader society and business costs. And so ultimately, if we can move 2-3% reduction in recidivism by really focusing extensively and heavily on the intervention services that are being provided, and then supporting that through community supervision, that is the way we ultimately manage our population in a meaningful way and produce better public safety outcomes at the same time.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just noticing that you commented that the unemployment rate was like 27% of those leaving the facilities, and yet we have a workforce shortage. Are we graduating people from prison to complete their sentence with the kind of skills that they need to be able to re-enter or even enter the workforce?
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas is an excellent question. We are doing, there's a lot going on from the way of education, vocational training, even just the opportunities for people to get work skills in the correctional facilities. And we've spent a lot of time over the last several years, to the extent that COVID allowed us to, meeting with businesses across the state and so many of our nonprofit partners across the state who have been doing job placement, working closely with DEED, because we know that Minnesota's economic vitality demands that every available worker be active. And what we know from the research is that activating our population, every month the Department of Corrections releases 600, 500 to 600 people from its system, every month. And if we were able to just think about that by way of workforce impact, if we were able to put these people into meet our workforce needs. And we have a lot of services. In fact, you will be seeing some proposals coming forward this session that ultimately will help to focus that attention of making sure these people do become a part of the solution and the future of Minnesota's economic vitality as it relates to workforce.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and Commissioner, can you tell me who in the organization chart here is actually responsible for the stats, the things like recidivism? And I'd like to know just, and also, I guess, who to contact to get information from the Department of Corrections on recidivism, maybe the training versus recidivism, things like that. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have Dr. Grant Dewey as our researcher, and you're going to hear from him. Dewey, it's D-U-W-E, later in the session. But he's a preeminent, and really we're really lucky to have him as our researcher. He does all of this work and has done extensive work of looking at what the benefits of doing. Of doing evidence-based practices and achieving those kinds of outcomes. And certainly Emily would be our first contact and can get you connected with Dr. Dewey whenever that, whatever information you need.
Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. So on page 10 is the graph that shows the reduction in prison population of about 1,500 in the last 3 years. So I imagine that most of your costs, though, are fixed. So my first question is, were there any cost savings, and are you able to repurpose those savings into programming, or does it go back into the general fund? Question one. And then I'll wait with my follow-up question. Thank you.
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, yes, we did. We took a $21 million budget reduction because of the reduction of the prison population. So that was, it was not something that we were able to, you know, return those dollars into programming, because there was actually a budget reduction of the $21 million to reflect that projection. So there was no okay. particular savings. In fact, one of the challenges we've seen, as all of us have seen, is just the increases in costs that, you know, that was unaccounted for in that as well, at the same time.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you. Then, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, are you experiencing still a workforce shortage in terms of prison guards and staff? That is your staff having to work overtime, and that adds to your costs then as well?
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, yes, this has been an ongoing challenge. We know that this is a case certainly in our state prisons and our county jails. Law enforcement is experiencing this as well. Workforce shortages are a huge challenge. And we, well, right now we are at, compared to our authorized strength, funded strength, about 91% staffed. And, you know, we struggle with retention. We still have high levels of overtime requirements, because one of the things that happens in correctional facilities, we fix, you know, there many are those positions, especially security positions, are fixed posts. So if I'm gone today and I'm supposed to work that fixed post, that's going to mean that, you know, Emily is going to have to work to cover that post. So it's one of the challenges that we've faced. Certainly overtime has been a factor. We've been able to address the overtime cost because of our vacancy rate. But ultimately, for the good of our staff, we need to stabilize our own workforce.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Senator Lass. Commissioner Schnell, so what we know is folks who have high ACEs scores, adverse childhood experiences scores, have exponentially higher rates of any number of things, including incarceration. When a person is incarcerated in one of these facilities, do you do any screening for ACEs? And then what sort of trauma-informed care is available? Is that properly funded? And are you seeing the same challenges in terms of mental health care within that population as we see more broadly?
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we have, I would just say that as we look at the ACEs, one of the things that we did as part of this person-centered approach was we created, Dr. Dooley created this new self-reported assessment. And it was one of the things that was incredibly eye-opening when we looked at the high number of ACEs that people reported. And then, you know, we know the impact just of incarceration on the kids of those who are incarcerated, which is one of the significant ACE factors. So we saw incredibly high ACE scores among those who were in our prison population, and that speaks directly to both the need for trauma-informed services and mental health needs are pronounced. And, you know, we face challenges even being able to maintain and attract practitioners, mental health practitioners in the system. And ultimately, you know, we've been working a lot with the Department of Human Services on this issue as we see just growing numbers of people coming into the prison system who've not been able to access adequate mental health services all throughout, you know, the court process. And so it does become an ongoing challenge and something that, we need to identify strategies for, especially given the fact that 95% of these people will be coming back to communities where services are also challenged.
Commissioner, could you explain what ACEs is?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, it's adverse childhood experiences. There's a number of them and that we know are factors that result in creating challenging outcomes for young people in particular. But we wanted to look at what the adverse childhood experiences were of the people that are coming into our prison system. And that's when we began to see, specifically at the ACEs, the individual adverse childhood experiences that they had, because it really helped us take a more trauma-informed focus in terms of development of their case plans.
Don't see any more questions from the committee. So thank you, Commissioner Schnell, and I will also commend any member of the committee to reach out to Emily Leffels, who is a terrific resource for all of us.
Thank you so much.
Department of Public Safety. Commissioner Jacobson, welcome to the committee and the staff that you're bringing with you. Commissioner, go ahead whenever you're ready.
We're alive here, sir, but Chair Latz, members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to be here today. Very much appreciate it. And I had the honor of following my colleague, Paul Schnell, who I worked with for a number of years in the law enforcement profession as well. Again, my name is Bob Jacobson. I am the newly appointed Commissioner of Public Safety for the state of Minnesota. It's been my honor to have this opportunity to be able to serve our state in this role. Like the young man in the back, I am starting my second week with the Department of Public Safety, so we're in good company, sir. But I do look forward to that service. I'm new to the Department of Public Safety, but I'm not new to public safety. In my career, I've served 33 years in primarily law enforcement positions, 32 years plus as the chief of police, or 32 years with the city of New Brighton, the last 16 plus years of those serving as the chief of police and the director of public safety and the emergency management director for that city. So I do have a wide range of experience, again, not only in law enforcement, but as one of your colleagues in the fire service and certainly in the emergency management community as well. Served in the past, in fact, as the president of the Association of Minnesota Emergency Managers and also as president of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I also am not very good at retirement. As I tell my wife and my family, I'm an epic failure in retirement. And so let me explain a little bit about my epic failure, which puts me in this seat here today. Again, during that time with the city of New Brighton, I again enjoyed serving, retired at the age of 56 and a half, and I thought that that was time enough served, and I was going to go into retirement. That lasted all of about 24 to 48 hours. I ended up accepting a job teaching and training for the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. I really focused during that time in my training on leadership around the state of Minnesota, putting on conferences for my colleagues around the state. I also helped work on wellness programs for the Chiefs of Police Association and created a peer support program for a number of our colleagues around the state. So I felt a real calling again to uplift the profession through the Chiefs of Police Association and during my time there. I retired again and then found myself getting a call from the Department of Human Services. I served two different times, once as an interim inspector general during a leadership transition, and also most recently I served in child safety and permanency for over 4 months. I worked with foster care programs, homelessness issues, a number of issues that really impact children and families, and that became very important to me also in my career. In between there, I also served as the interim police chief for the city of Stillwater. So again, as you can see, I'm not very good at retirement. Thought long and hard about this position, but this is one, my heart is still in service. Really look forward to having the opportunity to continue to serve in this role. And again, I look forward to working with all of you. Just know that looked to take this position, not because necessarily I wanted to continue working, but I have a heart of service that really, this position really attracted me to be here, and I hope I can be of great service to the state. On to our next slide. Just today I'm gonna give just a quick overview as best I can on the Department of Public Safety, give you an overview so you can understand a little bit about the complexity of our organization. As you know, we have 11 different operating divisions, and we have over 2,100 employees with the Department of Public Safety. As you also know, we're broken down. We report to two different committees, one the Transportation Committee, and today here with the Public Safety Committee. Today we're going to focus really on what falls underneath the Public Safety Committee's jurisdiction, which would include our Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, our Fire Marshal Division, the Office of Justice Programs, our Emergency Communication Networks, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Just a brief history lesson also in the Department of Public Safety, and I've been learning about this this week as well. But the Department of Public Safety was created in 1969, so I'm actually older than the Department of Public Safety, so I think this is right where I belong. But it does have a great history. One of the most recent additions to the Department of Public Safety and our structure, which I think is really important, is the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Office that was created in 2021 with, I know, the support of the legislature and our governor's office, and we're very happy that that's in place, and we've got great staff working on that already. First other division I'm going to talk about is Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. As the title explains, primarily that division oversees alcohol and gambling enforcement. It has a mix of sworn officers and non-sworn staff that work on gambling and alcohol issues, overseeing those laws and those rules. When it comes to alcohol specifically, we're responsible for a number of things, as you can see on the slides, but some of the most frequent are the issuance of alcohol licenses and permits, and we do a lot of inspections, compliance, and investigations along with that. The gambling side of alcohol and gambling enforcement, we cover gambling issues and games such as pull tabs, bingo. We monitor the 18 tribal casinos that are within our state, And in 2022, we completed 170 gambling investigations, which I think is really important. Some of the accomplishments, I learned this on my first week in the job too, but we have added our first canine to alcohol and gambling. The canine's name is Bia. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'll be corrected if that's not right. And Bia is currently the only currency detection dog in the state of Minnesota. So if we're doing an investigation, we need to find currency. Bia gets called up to help us go find that. And then also I think of significant note is that we added body cameras for all of our agents that are in the field. Next, I'll go to the State Fire Marshal's Office, and you can see that the State Fire Marshal's Office is led by Jim Smith. Again, Fire Marshal's Office is designed to help keep us safe and provide leadership and guidance in support of our fire and life safety policies, enforcement, prevention, education. Some of the work that the State Fire Marshal's Office has been able to complete over the last year especially, our investigators have helped local fire departments across the state of Minnesota with 921 investigations in 2022, so we're a great service to our fire partners and law enforcement partners from around the state of Minnesota. We also have a fire service specialist who's worked with Minnesota fire officials more than 600 times with issues ranging from fire consolidation to fire reporting. We also have a fire chief boot camp for those that are interested in becoming fire chiefs. For new, those upcoming leaders in the fire service, and they've trained 82 officers from 52 fire departments, and it's a great program, and glad that we have that. And we also collect and maintain data for fire data so we can see trends and monitor issues in the state. Some of the achievements for the State Fire Marshal's Office. Just in November, the State Fire Marshal's Office launched a predictive model risk mapping tool to assist in targeting high-risk areas with fire prevention and risk reduction to help stop fires. We're all about prevention. And also completed thousands of different inspections, and you can see it at various different locations from around the state of Minnesota. Office of Justice Programs, our Executive Director, Kate Weeks, is also here and leads that division. They work primarily to reduce crime, improve the criminal justice system, and a big part of their work is to assist crime victims. Some of the services that we provide from the Office of Justice Programs, it focuses on, again, crime victim services, justice and community grants, training, our prevention intervention work at OGP is critical, really, to trying to help create a safer Minnesota. We managed over 619 grants in 2022, totaling over $100 million. So we're investing a lot of money into these grants. On to the next slide, some of the achievements for the Office of Justice Programs. We've assisted families and advocates, again, with our missing and murdered Indigenous relatives cases in Minnesota. We've worked with more than 1,000 crime victims, criminal justice professionals, and members of the public, and we've opened 16 formal cases through the Minnesota Crime Victim Justice Unit. We've also received nearly 2,000 new reparations claims and coordinated payment of over $3.2 million to those crime victims. We also support the work of Minnesota's Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. The next division is the Emergency Communication Networks. The Division of Emergency Communications has really five programs, and they manage two very critical public safety communication networks, and they are led by our director, Dana Wahlberg. The ECN 911 program coordinates design, maintenance, and management for 911 calls at 103 call centers, 911 call centers across the state of Minnesota. Those call centers are all operated by local government, but we support those. The 911 systems handle about 2.9 million calls a year, which is a tremendous amount. We also work with the Armor Radio Program, which many of you have heard about, and we appreciate. It's a infrastructure necessary for emergency responders. For interoperability, you've probably heard that term mentioned several times when it comes to law enforcement, the ability to be able to communicate, not only with fellow from fire to police to emergency management, but we need to be able to communicate to respond well to emergencies and tragedies across the state. We also oversee the public alert warning systems, or IPAWS. In 2022, another good statistic, residents and visitors were alerted to some type of danger in the state 272 times. 50 of those alerts were sent by public safety agencies. 141 were weather-related alerts, and we certainly have our weather here in the state of Minnesota, and 91 of those were for testing. Some of the achievements of the emergency communication networks is that we're continuing to move to the next generation 911, text to 911, smart devices that are calling 911. All this technology is needing to be integrated into our communication centers. We also, which I think was really important, and we've publicized it, but we partnered with Minnesota Department of Health on the rollout and development of the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, the 988 number, which I think is key for us in the state of Minnesota. Next up, we're going to talk about Homeland Security and Emergency Management. The director, interim director, is Kevin Reed, longtime member of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And again, as they talk about frequently, they're there to prepare, respond, and recover from emergencies and disasters, which we certainly have here in the state of Minnesota. A quick overview, some examples of our services. The Minnesota School Safety Center, which focuses on prevention, planning, and policy in schools. And of course, safety in schools is all important. Homeland Security also operates the State Emergency Operations Center, which again, during times of disaster, it's the hub for state agencies and local agencies to partner to provide and coordinate the best possible response. We also provide Homeland Security training for our emergency management public safety professionals around the state of Minnesota. Some of the highlights from Homeland Security and Emergency Management, we responded to 3 presidential disasters totaling about $50 million in damages, 12 state disaster declarations for about $12.3 million in damages, and we have initiated 106 instructor-led training courses equaling over 1,000 hours during that time. So that's a quick overview of those divisions. I understand, Chair Latz, that we perhaps wanted a little bit more detail from the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension today, too, and what they do. And again, since I'm on day 7, I thought it would be best to bring along the superintendent of the BCA, Drew Evans, to come and talk to you about that. So with Chair Latz's permission, I'll turn it over to Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome, Superintendent Evans. You're not on day 8, are you?
No, Chair Latz. For everybody that I haven't met on the committee, my name is Drew Evans. I am the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and have been in that role for a number of years. I look forward to continuing to work with those of you that we've worked with on this committee in this role and then continuing with those that are new. So thank you for having us to the committee today. I was asked to provide a little bit of an overview of the BCA in a little bit more detail than some of the other divisions, and I'm happy to do that here today and then provide, certainly we're here to answer any questions, the commissioner and then the rest of the Department of Public Safety. Our mission at the BCA is to prevent, investigate, and solve crimes in collaboration with our criminal justice partners. And our vision is to deliver exceptional law enforcement services for a safer Minnesota. What that means and what we view our role is for the committee is really providing resources, whether it's expertise, analysis, personnel, to our law enforcement and criminal justice partners across the state of Minnesota as those communities work to keep their communities safe. We are located as a statewide agency across the state. What you can see in front of you here today, the stars are areas that we have field offices located across the state of Minnesota where we have special agents or our sworn component of the BCA that provide assistance to our law enforcement partners across Minnesota. Our headquarters location is here in St. Paul, and we certainly welcome any and all of you on the committee to visit. We'd be happy to provide a tour and provide a greater in-depth overview of the work that we do, and certainly to help you to accommodate that. We currently operate 12 of those field offices across the state. The one that we're missing here is we recently added a field office location in the White Earth Nation, partnering with our tribal law enforcement, working to disrupt fentanyl in particular and opioids into our tribal nations across Minnesota, and it made sense to partner and be located in that location. We operate a regional office in Bemidji, Minnesota, which is also a location where we have a laboratory. So we have a regional office with our sworn special agents, and then also we operate one of our two laboratories, which I'll cover in greater detail as we move on. We have three large divisions, which is Minnesota Justice Information Services, which I'll talk about in a moment, the Forensic Science Services Division, and then our Investigations Division. Our Investigations Division is composed of several different sections. The first section is our Predatory Crime Section. That's composed of special agents and professional staff that work to disrupt several different things. One is the disruption of the distribution and consumption of child sexual abuse material, often referred to as child pornography, but it's abuse material, and so the terminology you hear me use from here on out is child sexual abuse material. We've gone in that section from just a few years ago, approximately 3,000 tips for that type of activity in 2019 to this past year in 2022, the number of tips of suspected child sexual abuse material and online exploitations will exceed 7,000 cases coming into the BCA. We've seen a significant increase. We also operate our predatory offender registry system out of that, which is the registry of our predatory offenders across Minnesota, which currently sits at about 18,800 offenders. That team will work with our law enforcement partners across Minnesota when those individuals become non-compliant, trying to get them into compliant and then prosecution if it's warranted, if it's an intentional attempt to escape registration requirements. The other component of that section is our Minnesota Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force. That section works primarily on sex trafficking across the state of Minnesota, working with our partners, but also that team that comprised of both BCA personnel and then partners from Minneapolis, St. Paul Police Departments, Ramsey County Attorney's Office, Anoka County Sheriff's Office, Homeland Security Investigations, among others, work on a statewide basis to disrupt trafficking across Minnesota. We also work on some limited labor trafficking, but we are limited due to the scope and the funding mechanisms that we have available for that work. We operate regional offices that we noted that include those field offices. Primarily, those agents include predatory crimes agents, homicide agents, and our agents that are conducting narcotics trafficking, which focuses primarily on mid to upper level drug trafficking across Minnesota, working with all of our violent crime enforcement teams across Minnesota, the drug task forces currently operating in Minnesota. And their primary work is related to methamphetamine and opioids that we see trafficked across Minnesota. Our violent crime investigations are primarily death and homicide investigations, assisting local jurisdictions with that, and then also missing person cases out of that section. Our newest unit is our force investigations unit that the legislature created several years ago to address use of force cases and incidents involving police officers across Minnesota. That section also investigates allegations of criminal sexual conduct involving peace officers. Whenever that's occurred, they're required to have this unit investigate those cases. And then recently we added instances where a Minnesota National Guard member is reported a sexual assault allegation involving a Minnesota National Guard member, and the victim survivor in that instance is a Minnesota National Guard member, and we're doing those cases at this point in time too. I will note that this unit has a sunset for funding as of this year, but that unit has been up and operating and has been conducting those cases across Minnesota. The next section is our Minnesota our financial crime section that conducts fraud work and also operate the Minnesota Financial Crimes Task Force that works with partners across the state of Minnesota to fund investigations and work on that work. We also have a digital support conducting, as you may imagine, really any investigation we conduct at this point in time involves some sort of digital multimedia, whether it's the computer in front of you, phones, iPads, whatever it may be. And for us, I'll talk about the laboratory in a minute, but we have a unique partnership internally. Our digital multimedia evidence laboratory section is in our investigations division, but we find it very important for that section to be accredited. So they are accredited in the same matter as the rest of our laboratory, and our laboratory oversees our quality assurance program for that section. And then lastly, in the investigations division is our criminal information and operations section. This section provides analytical resources to either analyze the crime that we're seeing, to provide support to our cases, or share information across our local, state, and federal partners across the state. Our next section is our Forensic Science Services Laboratory. We're the state's all-service laboratory. Our main location at our headquarters location is what we conduct. A full-service laboratory is how we refer to it. It conducts everything you see on the slide in front of you. Our busiest sections for us are biology, chemistry, and our firearms sections within the BCA. Our DNA laboratory continues to look for ways to innovate and take on additional casework. We've seen a fairly significant uptick in the number of cases, in particular in our DNA firearms laboratory, as Minnesota has experienced a surge in the related violent crime over the past several of years. It goes without saying that that laboratory has seen an increase in the number of cases that's submitted. 2022 looks like it's going to be down slightly from 2021, which is good news, but still remains elevated in the number of cases that are coming in for analysis into our lab. We operate a location in St. Cloud that we've developed a partnership with the St. Cloud Police Department to do some limited drug analysis out of that location, and then also as an intake location out of the St. Cloud Police Department, working in partnership with them there. Our toxicology lab has experienced through COVID as well a significant increase in the number of cases, and the reason for that is our toxicology laboratory does analysis in blood and urine, primarily in impaired driving offenses that are across the state of Minnesota. And as we experience COVID, obviously our peace officers across Minnesota didn't conduct as many breath alcohol tests, so they switched to these types of tests, which drove up that, but it also drove down the number of breath alcohol testing that we do. The BCA is responsible to maintain the fleet of breath alcohol testing instruments for the state of Minnesota, and then we also do all the training for that as well. The one thing that I'd note of interest for our laboratory that would be of interest to this, as we come out of the COVID backlog, we do all of the analysis that we do here, but what we're experiencing currently in terms of just juggling a number of priorities is our staff now are going out to provide testimony on all of the cases that they've been conducting as our courts experience a significant backlog through the COVID pandemic. And so we are seeing our staff going out to testify all across the state of Minnesota, which is going to put increased strain and pressures on the work that they do day in, day out. Our Minnesota Justice Information Services section is our section that maintains really all of the criminal justice records for the state of Minnesota through a variety of applications, working in partnership with all the different entities such as the Department of Corrections, the court system, et cetera, to try to provide information to make informed decisions. You can see examples down below of what we are working on and what the systems are available to Minnesota. In particular, that some of you may have heard of, our criminal history system for the state of Minnesota that was recently updated in the last 4 or 5 years, and we continue to make improvements to that. Law enforcement incidents, which is part of our crime reporting, that we can provide a greater information available to our law enforcement partners. And one of the things that we're currently working on is updating the ABIS, which is our automated biometric identification system, which you provided funding for. This is updating our system that takes in primarily fingerprints for the state of Minnesota, so you can think of it as our way of identifying fingerprints for criminal history. Some people don't realize that in Minnesota, when you are booked, your criminal history is tied to that set of fingerprints. That's how we identify who the individual is across Minnesota. So it's really important we have a very robust system for that. Two last things that I'll highlight for you. Minnesota really is a leader when it comes to creating workflows that are efficient for the state of Minnesota. In particular, two systems that we use is our e-charging system. The vast majority of all charging documents in the state of Minnesota are routed electronically through the BCA's e-charging system. That means that when a peace officer signs a complaint in a criminal case, it's routed through the system completely electronically from start to finish. That helps us reduce errors, it obviously creates efficiencies in the process, and it ensures that everybody has insight to the same system really at the same time. Building on that platform over the last couple of years, as I noted before, transitioning from breath alcohol testing, for example, to toxicology, we are required to get search warrants in the field when a DWI is suspected, for example, when we're taking blood or urine. So we developed a new e-search warrant system so that peace officers can do that electronically, route it to judges for signing, and they can get that warrant electronically. I will tell you, as somebody that used to do homicide investigations and in greater Minnesota, where I'd often drive an hour or two one way to get a search warrant signed, it greatly created efficiencies in our system, and we're continuing to build upon that system to bring consistency and to ensure that we have the most efficient system possible. Some of our recent achievements include, and I'll conclude with this slide, is we've also created a new crime data explorer. Some of you may have read that there's a transition going on in crime reporting across the United States. Unfortunately, I have to report that there's a number of states that haven't come online for the FBI's deadline to report into a new national integrated, national incident-based reporting system across the United States, changing over from our uniform crime report. For us in Minnesota, this means that we're going to get much richer data than we've ever had before to understand the types and complexity of crime occurring in our state. Minnesota, I'm proud to tell all of you, transitioned completely and that you are getting that information. A component of that was building our new crime data explorer that you used to get a report from the BCA only one time a year, in July, summer, late summer every year. That data has now been put online. I encourage all of you to go look at it as we continue to improve that so it's available to our partners, to the public, et cetera, to really understand crime on an ongoing basis, not just once a year. We're moving towards electronic juvenile petitions. We have the system built right now so that e-charging data I just told you about is also going to be implemented for all juvenile petitions across the state, and we're working with our partners to do that now. We've seen significant increases, as you've seen, across all of state government and our concerns about cybersecurity, and we have the same concerns. We have hundreds of thousands of unwanted traffic on our systems every single week, and we have hundreds, if not thousands, of integrations into BCA systems. So we've been working to improve our cybersecurity. We made a number of different improvements to our systems to better protect that really important critical data. One of the things of interest to all of you that you implemented just in the last couple of years is a new sexual assault tracking system, KIT tracking system across Minnesota. This system is designed to bring greater accountability throughout the system so that from the time a KIT leaves the BCA and we provide them for all of law enforcement across the state of Minnesota to the time that it comes in for analysis to a prosecutor, it provides a window into that system as to where that KIT is at, from our law enforcement to our sexual assault nurse examiners across the state of Minnesota, to most importantly, our victim survivors, so that we can ensure that those kits are treated appropriately and the kits that are cleared for testing in our laboratories across the state, that that is happening as an additional mechanism. That's been rolled out, it's being used, we continue to tweak and improve that system, and we're proud to say that system is online. We also had a record number for CODISITS. That's the combined DNA index system. That's the system where we put in hits that or evidence that we get in our DNA laboratories, and then our offenders are in the same system to connect crime scenes, and we had more than ever last year to aid our investigations. We've also implemented a new system working with our partners at the FBI and then all of our local law enforcement threat to life program. This is just an example of another improvement that we're making as we've seen, unfortunately, mass violence events, whether it's in our schools, our faith-based institutions, or other mass gatherings, where somebody may have made a threat that we can quickly work together, that that information comes to the BCA, and then we work with our local law enforcement partners. The way this would work, for example, is if a kid that we've seen makes a threat online saying they're going to commit an act of mass violence, that gets reported into the system. Because of our contacts and work with our local partners, it comes to the BCA in our criminal information operations section. We can work with local law enforcement to try to disrupt that threat from occurring and being carried out. And then lastly, I will leave with, we've been working with, as you've seen, significant increases in violent crime, in particular in the Twin Cities. We've worked with our local and federal partners to really come together as a team. We've had 12 agents assigned working with the city of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and surrounding suburbs in particular to focus on proactive gun investigations, violent crime investigations, homicides, and other areas where we can really disrupt gun trafficking and those violent crimes from occurring. And I can tell you that in that time that we've been operating since just April, we've arrested over 640 people that for violent acts, working with with our partners and seized over 340 guns during that time period that are taken off our streets not to be used in another crime. So that work is ongoing, but it has put a strain on us because it is something we typically haven't done in that work going forward. But the results are positive that we have seen some reductions, but it's important in working with them to keep up some of that work. And with that, I will pause for questions of the committee, of myself, or Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner and Superintendent. It's good to have that all that information. Commissioner, did you want to add anything before we take questions, or should we just see if there's anyone who wants to ask anything?
I will just add, if I didn't say it, several of our staff are behind us. As I came into the Department of Public Safety again on just starting my second week, we have some great staff that are here behind me. If there are additional questions that I'm not able to answer, the real reason I bring that up is that in my first week here at the Department of Public Safety, I found that we have high quality staff who are committed to working on behalf of the state of Minnesota, and I really feel very fortunate just to be able to serve with this team that you see behind me.
Thank you. Any members of the committee have any questions? Senator Pappas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to start with Superintendent Evans. Superintendent, we all hear over the years a lot about the backlog and sexual assault kits. Can you kind of give us an update as to what's happening in Minnesota?
Superintendent Evans.
Thank you for that question, Chair Latz and Senator Pappas. We have currently, in terms of the backlog of sexual assault kits, there's two things that we look at, and it's important for the committee to know the difference between the two. A number of years ago, you all asked to have a accounting of the kits that were sitting on shelves across Minnesota that were not tested. We have been working with under some federal grants with a number of different partners, including a multidisciplinary team, to work through the backlog of these, what we call 2015 and before kits, the kits that were not tested that should have been a number of years ago. We are all but done with a number of those kits, including the 1,700 kits that were identified after that accounting by the Minneapolis Police Department, that we put a plan into place to work with them and the Hennepin County Attorney's Office to test those kits. I think we're under 200 kits left to be tested as part of that program. The other piece of that is the number of kits and the time frame that it takes to test the kits. You have provided additional resources to the BCA to test sexual assault kits in particular, as to ensure that there's a expedited turnaround time for all of those. Some of the reporting that's been done on this appears that there was a prioritization of violent crime cases over sexual assault kits. So I think it's really important for everybody on the committee to know that violent crime and sexual assault is obviously a violent crime, and it's prioritized the same way that all violent crime is within the BCA. And that's how we prioritize the DNA work, as violent crime cases get done first, and then we work down to property crimes in that process. We, because of the significant increase in the number of cases that were submitted to the BCA over the last several years, are experiencing high turnaround times right now. Right now, the number that I have on the sheet in front of me is DNA is on average taking about 134 days, but the sexual assault examination kits, including other violent crime, is actually higher than that. That's the first report. If you look at the totality of the case, we are experiencing turnaround time of 7 to 9 months right now to get DNA from the time it comes in the door to getting a report that's actually of value to our law enforcement partners in that process. I will tell you, we're working on a number of things that will reduce that, but due to the volume coming in, it's going to remain not to where we'd like to see, which is 30 days is our ultimate goal for DNA to come in the door and get back out. During that time, we are hiring staff. We had a number come online to be fully trained, but it takes us about a year to a year and a half to hire, from the time we hire to the time somebody's fully trained to do DNA analysis in our laboratory. A number of people have come online in December, and we anticipate more to come online in early spring of this year. That will help. We've also implemented some high-throughput robotic technology. We don't just wait for more people to come in the door to process more samples all at the same time. And that's been helping us, in particular, with property crimes. We're also currently looking at a another way if we can offload some of the property crimes to outsource that to a trusted laboratory we work with. But I will tell you, even that process for property crimes, not violent crime, will take about a year to get that back from that laboratory. But we think that will create additional capacity for us to address violent crime, and we're experiencing that right now in that process. And we also are implementing things such as rapid DNA to assist in cases where we can to bring that down. So we have in DNA in particular experienced kind of a significant increase, as we've noted, in violent crime, and it's going to remain elevated for a period of time, but we're doing everything we can to get through that. The most important takeaway that I want to ensure everybody knows, though, is that sexual assault kits are prioritized the same way all violent crimes, such as homicides, attempted murders, et cetera, they're all together in one. When we get through all of this, we do anticipate creating a standalone unit within our DNA laboratory that will focus exclusively on sexual assault examinations when we can get our staffing up to the right levels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Now I have a question for the commissioner. So during, it became obvious to some of us that the current Emergency Operations Center is inadequate. It's bad location. I don't even know if I want to say it publicly where it's located. And so I tried during COVID to get some tours over there, and they got canceled. In spite of that, the bonding committee did fund a new emergency operations center. Last year, we were told that the cost had gone up and that we were about $10 million short. We did not pass a bonding bill last year to totally fund it. Can you, Commissioner, can you or one of your staff members tell me, were you able to start the building of the new operations center without that additional $10 million, or are you still waiting for that? She's nodding and shaking, right?
Sure. Maybe I'll pass that off to our legislative advisor. Yep.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I'm Jordan Altofter, Director of Legislative Affairs for DPS. I will say that the process has not stopped. We have not broken ground on the building, but as the bonding bill last year showed, costs have risen and those cost pressures have not changed, but we are still moving forward with the project as much as possible.
So, Mr. Chairman, so you were able to still do some, you purchased the property, you're able to do design. Were you able to actually use the money that was appropriated in the 2020 bill, or is that still sitting there?
Mr. Ofterhoff.
Thank you, Chair Latz. Senator Pappas, I don't want to, I'll let our Director of Homeland Security Emergency Management answer, and I'll get back to you with that information, or the benefit of having Kevin Reed can come to the table.
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I'm Kevin Reed. I'm the Interim Director for Homeland Security Emergency Management, and we've continued the process. We've had to shrink our footprint, but we are estimating end of May to break ground. We are still short for the building that we designed, so we're trying to keep it as functional as possible for a 50-year building. We have been moving forward the design almost complete. We have the construction company. We have the land purchased. Nothing stopped other than the size of the building at this point.
Senator Pappas.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Reed, could you then just let me know how much more money you do need to complete it? You don't have to do it now, but at a later date.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Reed, if more money becomes available, can you resize the building to meet your original estimated need?
Senator Latz, that would delay it more. I think we've right-sized it, and we do have some add-ons that we can do if more money comes available. We do need a certain amount of money to actually build the building as it's currently designed from the original reduction. We do believe that is functional and that will still serve its purpose and the goals that you guys set as a functioning building for the CDOC and the offices for Homeland Security Emergency Management. But we do have some add-ons that would help from there, but we will be able to build with this.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Reed. Mr. Haltofter.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to want to make sure we are being clear up here. We've continued the process as much as possible, but we can't break ground on anything without additional funding.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question for Superintendent Drew Evans. Superintendent, you made mention of sexual assault investigations, 7 to 9 months it takes. You didn't mention the number of cases that are commonly in your file. Do you have just to give us a scale of how prominent this crime is, could you give me an indication of how many cases are usually in your case? That's not counting backlog, just your ongoing cases.
Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Chair Latz. Senator Limmer, I've got a very busy spreadsheet in front of me, so I will go through it here very quickly. But what we saw, just as an example for all of you, this is into the laboratory only. So these are kits that are coming in or case types that are coming into our laboratory. In calendar year 2022, it looks like we had about 1,500 cases that were submitted. That number is probably a little bit dated until we complete and finalize all this, which is down from calendar year 2021, which was about 22,448 cases, or where we ended up there. Calendar year 20 was 2,380 cases from there. If you look at going backwards just a few years prior to that, though, both in calendar year 2017 and 2018, it was about 1,200 cases that came into our laboratory in any given year. Those are cases that are case titled criminal sexual conduct cases.
Mr. Chairman, when one has a 7 to 9 month delay to get a diagnostic investigation completed, how does that affect the mood of the victim in wanting to first wait that long and then begin a prosecution where that particular victim may be the star witness? Is there a drop-off of cases that go the full route of prosecution?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Latz, Senator Limmer. Certainly, you know, as I noted before, our gold standard from our perspective is a 30-day turnaround time in all of our laboratories. You know, oftentimes in DNA in particular, if the case hinges on DNA analysis, not only to identify a perpetrator, but also to clear any innocent persons that may have been identified in the case, getting that information sooner than later is certainly important. I also think for, you know, all victim survivors in our system, seeing the system work swiftly and efficiently continues to breed confidence in that system. There are other steps that can certainly be taken by law enforcement during that time period, but it is important from our perspective to get that evidence out the door as quickly as possible. That is also the reason all violent crime is prioritized, that we want to get those cases out as quickly as possible to make sure that process is moving along as quickly as we can.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Limmer.
With a 1,200 to 1,500 caseload at any given time, do you have any comparisons with other states that are either a per capita or a similar state like Minnesota? At 1,200 to 1,500 ongoing cases just seems to be an astronomical number.
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Latz and Senator Limmer, and yes, it's, you know, I don't have that, but I can certainly ask that question, and I certainly follow up with you on that. And just to be, you know, clear, I was trying to look for a number here across the board when it comes from this, and I could get a breakdown certainly if there's value to it. You know, that's just criminal sexual conduct cases. We have a much higher volume overall of DNA analysis that we're doing, so that number is much larger for the DNA laboratory as a whole. But we can look at other cases. I do know there's a variety just from working with my colleagues from across the country in terms of really what the turnaround times are. Some are better and many are much worse than what we're experiencing. But we all agree on one thing, that turnaround time really should be much lower to impact those investigations in a positive way.
Mr. Chairman, in closing, I find that number to be provide me a little fear of the kind of the snapshot we have in our society if we have that many ongoing. And those are the ones that are actually reported. There's certainly a number that are not reported, either out of the fear of the victim or some other circumstance. So thank you, Superintendent.
Superintendent Evans, as a follow-up, this obviously is an issue of resources, and then there's a question of the pipeline. How quickly can you get up to speed if you were provided more resources? What would you estimate if we were to provide additional resources? Sounds like it would take a year to a year and a half before you could meaningfully increase the capacity of the lab.
Chair Latz and members of the committee, you know, as I noted before, we do have a number of scientists that are coming online right now from previous resources, but any additional resources, as you note, it certainly takes us a period of time to identify, hire, and train those individuals. We have strict training protocols, as you can imagine, and we have a lot of oversight of our scientists because of the necessary accreditation standards and to ensure that quality examinations are going out the door. So for our DNA lab, and this varies from laboratory to laboratory, in firearms, for instance, it takes us a longer period of time to train those individuals, but our DNA laboratory, from the time we start the hiring process to bring them online, a year to a year and a half is a pretty standard timeline. I will say we continue to identify really exceptional individuals with strong academic backgrounds to come into this field, and so we have had good success in hiring quality individuals.
So, Superintendent, can you give us some idea what kind of person is a new hire into a position like this? What background do they come to you with?
Chair Latz, members of the committee, really good question. We first start looking for trained scientists because that would greatly reduce the amount of time, but it's a fairly small field. Just as a comparison, law enforcement has about 10,500 law enforcement officers in this state. By comparison, there's probably less than 300 trained forensic scientists across the state of Minnesota. So many of our scientists come to us straight out of the university system, and most of them have a degree in one of the physical sciences, biology, chemistry, and then we train them from the ground up, and there's very limited academic systems anywhere in the United States that truly train a forensic scientist so they'd be ready to come into the door. So most of the training is through a training process we have developed internally.
So essentially, you're like a postgraduate program to create the kind of scientist that you need out of someone who's got a basic science background.
Chair Latz, members, I think that's an accurate comparison.
All right, thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. They're not related to each other. So if we get into detailed, please give me the signal to stop.
But gladly do so, Senator Carlson.
The first one is, you know, we're looking at a bill and an initiative to provide legal use of cannabis. And I see that you have toxicology responsibilities, you've done the DNA development. Are you or have you been requested to work on field testing for THC or when a person is under the influence, any of those kinds of things that you've been working on?
Superintendent?
Chair Latz, Senator Carlson, I can take a little bit of a piece of that. What are certainly within our laboratory systems, we are used to working in terms of impairment due to cannabis use. So that's something that's certainly not new, that doesn't change due to legalization that may come along with that as you examine these particular issues. And roadside field sobriety testing is certainly a component of impaired driving that we've been working on. You know, as the commissioner noted, this is somewhat of a bifurcated committee. I certainly look to my colleagues in roadside testing at the Minnesota State Patrol, who are the true experts in the state in terms of conducting those sorts of processes. But in terms of toxicology in our laboratory, we have had a number of discussions that have been ongoing for a number of years about how to address our roadside testing, and certainly our laboratory is always a component of that and has been engaged in such discussions over the years.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, my next question is, I brought a very serious issue to the Attorney General a couple of years ago, and the opinion of the Attorney General is it requires investigation, and so the Attorney General turned it over to the BCA. I've not heard another word from it since, and it was a very serious issue, and I'm wondering if and I'm sure that you follow the statute of not commenting on ongoing investigations. But I'm wondering if there's a way to find out whether this investigation is on hold, whether it was dropped, whether it's still being considered.
Chair Latz and Senator
Superintendent
Carlson,
Evans.
Please, if you get in contact with me, your staff, we'd be happy to follow up on that with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Another one is, and I'm hoping that you can speak to this, something called the Great Blue Leak happened a couple of years ago. And law enforcement has been very reluctant to talk about it. And the only reason I knew about it is reporters called me and said that my name was listed in some data from the Great Blue Leak. Now, my name is Jim Carlson, and I know that there's another Jim Carlson in Minnesota that's been in trouble before. So I don't know which of us is the person that they were referring to. So I'd like to know if you can give us any background on the Great Blue Leak. And how much has that damaged law enforcement abilities in Minnesota?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Latz, Senator Carlson, I confess I don't track this particular instance. I know there have been a number of breaches related to different databases, and if I had a little bit more information, I certainly could provide some. There was one about the same time frame that was related to a system that a number of information sharing groups worked on at the particular time. That has not impacted our ability to operate. We took some security measures and put into place to ensure the integrity of our data that was a third-party host solution that a number of different states utilized, if that's what they're referring to. So we continue to move on with that. But if there's more specificity or additional information, be happy to do that. We can do a little bit of research, but I'm not familiar with that actual terminology.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. But I have another question,
Senator
but I
Carlson.
Think that will probably be something we'll talk one-on-one.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Superintendent, the question I have is, you know, as we go forward the way it sounds with the legalization of cannabis, is there a test out there now similar to the alcohol that tells us that is an equivalent to 0.08 or 0.04? How do we go forward with that testing? Do we know that a person of X amount of size can be tested and we know that they're under the influence because they have X amount of THC in their system?
Superintendent Evans.
I can start, Chair Latz. And again, I Chair Latz and Senator Howe, when it comes to these particular issues, I know there'll be a lot more discussion about these sorts of issues and where they come. My understanding, and again, I would defer to my colleagues at the State Patrol and others that conduct a lot more of this type of analysis, but my through our toxicology work that we do at the BCA, one of the challenges that come along with this and setting a per se limit is it's generally been said that it is not advisable to set a per se limit when it comes to cannabis or THC in our particular instance. The reason for that from a toxicological standpoint is it's absorbed into an individual's system in a different manner than alcohol is. And so really what the general guiding principles have been doing is looking at a roadside field sobriety program that is really looking at our drug recognition experts across the state in terms of identifying who's actually impaired under these substances. And that's been the conversations that have been had for that. In terms of the actual is there a test out there right now? I think that the short answer is there's a lot of research that's going on this, and I don't know the current status of it. We'd have to follow up with you, but I know there's a lot of work that's being done in that field currently.
Mr. Althofter-Heide.
Very good, Chair Latz.
Did I get it right?
Chair Latz, Senator
Hall. It's a mouthful, I'm sorry.
I apologize for it. the Office of Traffic Safety and the State Patrol last year in the transportation budget did bring forward there's a drug driving test that can test up to 8 different active ingredients in someone's system, THC being one of them. So that is certainly something that we may look for, again, this session, the authorization to use that and potentially get some funding for it.
The trick is moving from the presence of the drug to whether or not the impairment has resulted, right? And there's a lot of studies on alcohol that links levels of concentration to impairment. As far as I'm aware, there's not much that links specific concentrations of THC to levels of impairment that can be generalized across populations. So It's an individualized determination in every case at the roadside by the DREs.
Senator Howell. Well, my experience comes from the military, of course, and we, you know, conducted your analysis once a month. And if you had anywhere near that, if you participated with that or used it within that 30-day period, you were gonna pop hot. And so, you're right. As far as my background goes or my experience goes, is it does definitely. You can say it was there. Now, what level that was at is a whole nother deal, and I guess that's where the major discussions are going to come down. And I appreciate the discussion, and I'm interested to see where we go.
Senator Howell, I agree with you. It's a critical question as we move in that direction to look for impairment levels and the impact. Of course, in the military, it might have been completely prohibited to use marijuana, and you can determine past use by the presence of the metabolite, which lasts 30 or 60 days, where the active ingredient of THC, it may only last 24 to 48 hours in a body.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're going to see that also with, if you're a truck driver or an airline pilot or whatever you are, as long as it's there and present, your employment's in trouble. So. Same thing with the military. So it'll be interesting as we move forward.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments by members of the committee? Commissioner, anything else?
Well, I just want to thank Superintendent Evans for coming along to answer all these questions. So that was just outstanding. Nothing else to add, Mr. Chair and members. But thank you again for the invitation to be here.
Thank you, Commissioner and staff. And just a reminder, members, we will have a committee on Wednesday. I'm going to try to be starting committee promptly at 12:30. So please be here a little bit early to be prepared to start. And thank you. Have a great couple of days here. We're adjourned.